Well, welcome. My name is Mary Ellen Mazey, and I have the honor and privilege of serving as the Dean of the Eberly College of Arts and Sciences. And I'm so pleased to have all of you here this evening for the reading and the alumni recognition of Chuck Kinder. As we were preparing for this evening, it was so wonderful to read your bio, Chuck, because you're quite an inspiration to many of our students, our faculty, and certainly to even us as administrators here at West Virginia University. So in terms of my remarks, I think we're here this evening to really celebrate Chuck Kinder's career, his robust creativity, his adaptability, and his zest for life. We're here to celebrate the outlaw nature that brought a boy from Montgomery, West Virginia to Morgantown, who, as he completed his education, wrote the very first creative writing thesis at West Virginia University. Then he went across the country and back again to make his literary mark alongside of some of the greatest of 20th century writers. His works include The Last Mountain Dancer, Hard-Earned Lessons in Love, Loss, and Honky Tonk, Outlaw Life, and Honeymooners, a Cautionary Tale. Professor Kinder is director of the Creative Writing Program at the University of Pittsburgh, and he earned both his bachelor and master's degrees in English from West Virginia University. He is an award-winning author of 4 novels, and he studied at Stanford. Along the way of becoming a noted author, he worked as a coal miner, a moonshiner, bartender, bouncer, prize fighter, and cowboy, just to name a few of his experiences. He served as the inspiration for the character Grady Tripp in the novel and film The Wonder Boys. We are here tonight to celebrate Professor Kinder as a role model of one who demonstrates the freedom to invent oneself, to adapt in the face of change, and to exercise a passion for his work. This is what an arts and sciences degree is all about, and that is what exemplifies Chuck Kinder's life. As the program will attest, Professor Kinder has been down many roads, and tonight we are so pleased that those roads have led him back to his alma mater to receive the Eberly College of Arts and Sciences Alumni Recognition Award. Professor Kinder, will you please join me here at the podium as we recognize your outstanding achievements and honor you as our favorite West Appalachian and West Virginian outlaw storyteller.
Excuse my limp. I had a knee surgery. Total knee replacement. So I consider myself brave tonight. Dean Mazey, this is really amazing. There are a lot of people I know who wonder where I stole this and where I put it. And thanks for that introduction. I know now at lunch I told you I think you all made a mistake. I think I'm here under false pretenses, and a very nice gentleman, as I walk in, asked how my football kicking career was going. I think I'm not that Chuck Kinder. And I told my friends in Pittsburgh, I think I'll pull this off as long as no one asks me to kick a football. Actually, Chuck Kinder and I were here about the same time, and I was mistaken for him a lot. He's a football player. We look quite a bit alike. And I started getting phone calls. He was also, he's a very religious man. He was a lay minister. I believe he still is a minister. And I get phone calls from various religious leaders in the area, you know, ministers. If I would come to speak to the youth services this summer. And I always said, no, you have the wrong, you mean Carl Kinder, not Charles Kinder. And I had his number by then, I'd give it to him. Well, the very first thing I ever had published in my life was a book review, the work, collected work of Jane Bowles. I worked on that, and I worked on that. I dropped, it was a perfect graduate student to review. I dropped every name I could possibly think of. I attended at several colleges throughout West Virginia, Marshall, West Virginia Tech, and I wanted to show all those old professors that I'd arrived. I had somebody published in the Charleston Gazette, and I remember the morning it was to be released. I ran down the old book stand, and I got a copy, and I ran home, and opened up, and there it was, and I read, and there was my name, Chuck Kinder. Chuck Kinder is the place kicker for West Virginia University. So, what I did, I received further calls. Chuck, would you come out and speak to our youth group on Sunday? Yeah, what time? What time do you want me there? Well, years later, Chuck and I, we know one another now, and I was doing a reading in Charleston, and it was fun to meet him. I died to meet him. And he confessed to me, he said, my mom went out and bought a dozen papers with that review in it. And he said, I never told my mom that I didn't write it. Whereupon, I told him what I'd done. He had a good deal of Christian forbearance, and he forgave me. And we became friendly. I've been waiting for the hook. The hook all day to put me off to the side that this is not true. And I have to address a couple of things. My dear old Professor John Stasny just asked me about, John asked me, for instance, Chuck, what's this about some of your awards, a most improved prisoner of the month commendation from the Fed, from the West Virginia Fed County Christian Jailers Association. Well, they took this information from my bio on the University of Pittsburgh, their faculty website. And I was sort of goofing on the idea of dust jackets and what you try to include in your dust jackets. And if there was just a breath, a kernel of truth in anything, this cowboy business, I fell off a pony a couple times. But what they did not put in is the first line of my bio, where I say, before he became a full-fledged fictioneer, meaning writer, whose personal philosophy is that everything one writes should be as literally true as the Bible, et cetera, et cetera. Now, think about that for a moment. I'm literally, and then I commenced to just dust track this to death, and I just had to had to add the Christian Jailers Association. I'm not saying that there's not a kernel of truth to that, but I don't need to elaborate. And that's all a part of being sort of a fictioneer and a writer, I think. Very briefly, I got my MA from here, my BA and MA. I did write the first creative writing thesis. I can't think of a thing I've been more proud of in my life than doing that. I left here, and I was teaching at Waynesburg College, and I got on a Greyhound bus. I left my first wife behind me, and I was going to go to California, the age of Aquarius, to San Francisco, and become a flower child, and an enterprise I failed at utterly. And I was lucky enough to get into Stanford. And I used my thesis that I wrote here. It was called Memorial Day then. That was what I used to get into Stanford. And later it was published by Alfred Kamal, a very good New York publisher. It was called Snake Hunter then. But I wrote that at the heart of it here, while I was here. And at Stanford, I really was sort of a little hillbilly boy. And I thought I'd be way in over my head. And I didn't need a Merrily's Fellowship, and that's where you take regular courses besides the writing classes. And I was in classes with PhD students who received their MAs from places like Harvard, Yale, Princeton, University of Chicago, Berkeley. I was in with some heavy hitters, and I realized, and this is not because I was particularly articulate or God knows intelligent, but I was well educated. I more than held my own, those students inside and outside of class. They were really flabbergasted. And as I said, it's just because of the education I had here. Someone a moment ago asked me about Rule Foster, was the chair when I was here. John Racine was a teacher of mine. Russ McDonald, the very first creative writing class Russ McDonald taught, and I was there, Virgil Peterson, John Johnson, there were some really wonderful teachers. But chief among them were Professor John Stasny. John Stasny, I've had two men who I consider mentors in my life. One was Richard Scoker, who was the director of writing at Stanford and a dear, dear friend of mine. And the other was John Stasny. John, his field of expertise is Victorian studies. None of you really know me, but those who do know me, they're absolutely flabbergasted that I would be drawn into Victorian studies. Well, I'm the least likely Victorian you'd ever meet. Yet to this day, I consider myself proudly an Arnoldian. I use this as sort of a rhetorical technique for people with my little hippie, aging hippie ponytail and all this and that, and my little bit, some of my redneck ways. I get into a discussion about something, even with colleagues today, and I'll flabbergast them because I can suddenly launch into a discussion about Empedocles on that, or culture and anarchy. And that's John Stasny. I mean, that upper hand. I can remember vividly classes. I remember one class. I have no idea if you remember this, John, or not. But we were discussing the Record of the Deutschland by Hopkins, and what I was trying to do was point out in the back of the room in a snide, punk grad student kind of way. I was trying to point out all the homoerotic imagery in Hopkins. And I felt I was arguing Cardinal Newman. At any rate, John Stasny set me on a path that the habits of mind, the ways of thinking, I've benefited from them my whole life. So that gentleman I owe a great deal. In my book, Last Mountain Dancer, at the end of the book, I acknowledge John. They misspelled his name. In the new edition, I hope it was spelled right, but I started thinking, that's probably good. I don't want John to ever be blamed for Last Mountain Dancer. I mean, for anyone ever to attribute anything about that to him. He was very, very important to me. Well, I'm supposed to read tonight, and I'll read a couple short chapters from it. This is my Last Mountain Dancer. Yes, I call it a meta-memoir, basically because I use the word meta because I sort of rise above my true life. We're talking today in a Mark Rozee's class with some of his students and talking about memoir and the fine line between fiction and nonfiction. And I must admit, even though I'm supposed to be writing a memoir, I don't deal with facts too well. So it is sort of a combination of fact and fiction that I like to call factions. And that's what I deal with in that particular book. In 94, I was on sabbatical, and I wanted to write a book about Jessica White, a nonfiction book. And Jessica and I have become friends. And it didn't work out for one reason or another, but I moved down to Fayetteville, and I rented my brother-in-law's sister's little house. She had gone on down to Charlotte, the bright lights of Charlotte, to live in he would be her husband, Ron, and his double wide down there. And so all through the book, my sister and brother-in-law are main characters. My sister, John and Beth Kemper, and I call my sister throughout the book, my lovely sister. And I call my brother-in-law my handsome hair suit brother-in-law. He took a little umbrage about how I really described him. And one other person I just have to say something about is my wife Diane, or my fiance. It's probably better. We thought we were getting married in Missoula, Montana about 33 years ago. And we did. We had a preacher. We did everything. Fed the preacher chicken and dumplings. Did the whole thing. Diane, when we moved to California, and she was looking through my chaos of an office, all my old papers and stuff, whereupon she found my divorce papers from my first wife. I hadn't been divorced yet. I mean, we just missed it by a day or two. So we've been living in sin for 33 years. On our 30th anniversary, I got her an antique diamond ring as an engagement ring. And we went out to dinner, and I just, will you do it again, baby? She looked at me. She had to drink three martinis before she finally said, okay, so now we're, at least we're officially engaged. So there's that. This is the first chapter of Last Mountain Dancer. And I read this because it's easier to read in smaller print in my book, and I got cataracts. Everything, I was falling apart. I was thinking to my dozies, I was falling apart. But it's called, as I said, it's the opening chapter of Last Mountain Dancer. It's called The Girl with No Face. And I don't know how many folks outside of West Virginia remember Dagmar anymore, but once she was famous. I'll bet everyone in the room knows who Dagmar is, right? I've read this a couple other times at other places, and people have no idea who Dagmar is. I mean, none whatsoever. Even when there be people in the audience approximate of my own age. But anyway, but once she was famous, back in the early and mid-50s, Dagmar had been black and white TV's version of Marilyn Monroe, or maybe more accurately, a B-movie Queen Jane Mansfield. Dagmar was the resident dumb blonde with big breasts on the old Beltonboro Texaco Theater, where she cultivated a funny, startled, deceptively stupid look. She also appeared on the TV variety show Broadway Open House and even had her own short-lived Dagmar's Canteen in 1952, where Frank Sinatra was once a guest. I've even asked kids, do you know Frank Sinatra is? Who? Who? Dagmar had been my own first hope and inspiration for a future beyond the ordinary. She had become the source of all my earliest discovery and flight and fame fantasies, but I let Dagmar and her famous big breast slip through my fingers. Dagmar's real name was Virginia Ruth Egnor, and she was born in 1924 in Huntington, West Virginia. When I was a boy, Dagmar's folks had lived three doors down from us on Waverly Road in Huntington for several years. There were no fences around the small frame houses on our road back in those days, and we kids darted in our games like free-range chickens across that little prairie of backyards. In Dagmar's folks' backyard, there was a spreading oak tree, old oak, we often used as home base, for I relished the role of being it during hide-and-seek. Being it meant that I could hover about that home base old oak, where it was only a matter of time until one day Dagmar would discover me. Sunday, Dagmar would be sitting, visiting her folks, maybe sitting out at the kitchen table, sipping coffee one morning with her mom, when, through the back window, she would spot a singular, swift, beautiful boy, fearless in his play. And with a mere glance, Dagmar would recognize the shining of his inner star. Dagmar would stub out the cigarette she had been languidly smoking while trying to explain the enigmatic nature of fame to her old mom. And she would rush out the back door to that special, splendid boy, rush to enfold him in her fame, not to mention extraordinary bosom, her fiery dimples, fiery red through her filmy, clingy negligee. I love those words. Nipples, negligee, nipples. Nipples, nipples, which were among those magically learned juicy words of my childhood. I would roll around on my tongue like holy cherry lifesavers. And then it really happened. Dagmar had actually shown up at her folks' little home on Waverly Road the summer I was 10. We awakened one August Saturday morning into all the ordinariness of our own lives to discover an enormous car parked in front of Dagmar's folks' little house. It was a Cadillac. It was a convertible. It was yellow. I love that yellow Cadillac convertible with all of my heart at first sight. The neighborhood was abuzz. One of Dagmar's prissy little nieces kept sashaying out of the house to preen and prance and keep everybody abreast of the radiant blonde being within. Apparently, Dagmar had brought her latest husband home to meet her folks for a real low-key down-home family visit. I skulked and lurked about the little frame house like all of the rest of the obscure neighborhood minions that Saturday morning, hoping to get at least a peek at the inscrutable face of fame, but to no avail. Around noon, my dad, or Captain, as everybody called him, piled as many neighborhood kids as he could round up in his old battered green Plymouth station wagon, as was his Saturday afternoon custom, and hauled us all down the road to a public swimming pool called Dreamland. Dad was called Captain because he had been the captain of the Second World War, which he had apparently won pretty much single-handedly. He was famous for this. When Dad had mustered out of the Army at the end of the war a hero, some folks had encouraged him to get into politics. Captain was a big, gregarious fellow with an easy, booming laugh, a full-blown sort of character folks always declared was a dead ringer for John Wayne, and it was true. Some folks even declared that Captain would be a natural for governor of West Virginia, although he was by nature neither a drunk nor a crook. Captain, who was a generally unemployed hero, hauled all us rowdy kids out of the neighborhood on weekends so that my mom, who was an emergency room night shift nurse, and who pretty much brought home the proverbial bacon in our house plus cooked it up, could collapse in peace. I recall Dreamland as a vast pool of wavy, faintly blue-green water splashing with sunlight, air thick with the pungent, puzzling sweetness of chlorine and suntan lotion, joyful screams and squeals strangely echoing, smooth, oiled teenage girls parading imperiously with their movie star sunglasses and implicating smiles and the sweet, shadowy secrets of their shaved underarms. Music was always blasting from a huge white stucco two-story clubhouse trimmed in blue, and blue onion-shaped domes rose above dressing rooms on a small knoll at the far end of the long pool. Dreamland was a Taj Mahal of a swimming pool I both loved and feared, a site of excitement and profound failure for me. Dreamland was where I learned to swim my first spastic strokes and where I failed repeatedly to muster courage enough to attempt swimming out to the deep end. I was not really afraid of drowning in the deep end. It wasn't that. It was, for one thing, my fear of not looking cool and sleek, swimming around like the older boys, the dopey as a duck, as I thrashed about in the water of the deep end. I was afraid of being embarrassed if I swam out to the huge circular concrete float in the deep end where the older boys hung out as they strutted and flexed their fulsome brown muscled bodies. Mostly, though, my fear of the deep end was because of the bad dreams. We piled out of Captain's old Plymouth station wagon that Saturday and charged for the ticket counters, bouncing about impatiently as we inched along in one of the two endless lines. And then I spotted her in the next line, the famous monster girl with no face. I had seen her maybe two or three other times, and it was always a shock. She was a monster girl whose face had no features. It was like looking at the blur of a face. You got the impression of holes here and there for what could have been perhaps nostrils and a mouth maybe, and eyes, like unaligned marbles amid folds and flaps of flesh and hair that looked like fur and feathers. There were rumors that the girl had been born that way, or that her face had burned off in a fire, or been cut to ribbons in a terrible car wreck, or by an escaped convict crazy man with a knife. Her blur of a face was at an angle to me, and I stared at it. I couldn't help it. I blinked my eyes trying to somehow adjust them, to get them into focus, to compose something recognizable as the regular human face of a girl amid the pulpy mess of skin. Suddenly, the monster girl turned her head in my direction and I jerked my eyes away. But she knew I had been staring. I could feel she knew I had been staring, and my neck burned with shame and embarrassment for her exotic horribleness. I couldn't think of anything worse than being her, a person whose face could never show her sadness or happiness if she ever had any, whose only expression would be horribleness. How could a girl with no face ever leave a dark room? How could a monster girl ever crawl out from under her rock? Let's head for the deep end, soldier boy. captain said to me the minute we laid our towels on a grassy slope above the pool that Saturday. "Let's go kick that deep end's ass," Captain added, laughing that bold, confident winner of the Second World War laugh of his. And he gave my shoulder a poke with his finger and about knocked me down. I was this bony kid who had at best a baffled sense of balance. Then Captain gave me a snappy salute, which meant that I, his little soldier boy, was supposed to snap him a salute back. A little private father-son camaraderie thing he had initiated when I was maybe a month old. I knew what this meant in a heartbeat. This meant that my cowardly ass was grass and the Second World War was a mower. I hated the Second World War with all my heart. This had also meant that Bob had ratted me out to Captain about the deep end and my cowardliness, and I resolved at that moment to keep my heart hidden from everybody forever. At noon each day, when I came home from playing or school for lunch, there would be two pans heating on the stove. One pan contained simmering Campbell's tomato soup. I love Campbell's tomato soup. A syringe needle were being sterilized in the other bubbling water. After I had enjoyed my Campbell's tomato soup, which I slurped with infinitely slow appreciation, while nibbling with elegant slowness upon the crumbs of saltines, Mom would lead me upstairs, and I would trudge forlornly behind her like the proverbial prisoner going to the gallows. I would lie face down on my bed with my butt bared until such time as I had worked up courage enough to gasp into my pillow a feathered, fluttering little whimper of that word, now. Whereupon, Mom would deliver into my sugary little boy butt, via that needle, the approximate size of a harpoon, my daily dose of raging male hormones. I had had a little undescended testicle problem that took four visits to the famous Mayo Clinic to eventually resolve. While I was working up the courage to say now, Mom would let me jabber my head off as I stalled. If I sensed Mom growing impatient with me, I would attempt to distract her with entertaining, albeit inscrutable, stories. Sometimes I would be forced to pretend to confide in Mom, telling her what I hoped would pass as truthful, private things, making my revelations as puzzling and painful as possible to engage her interests and sympathies. Hence I had told her more truthfully than I meant to about my fear of the deep end. And then I had told her about the nightmares I had for years, that as I was swimming along happily, some horrible, scaly creature who lived on the bottom of the deep end would awake and see me up there above on the surface of the water. Whereupon in my nightmares, I would feel something grab my feet from below and pull me screaming down under the water to be eaten raw. So there was Captain, treading water in the shivery blue-green water of the deep end, throwing salutes my way and hollering above the pool racket to jump on in, soldier boy, the water's right. But soldier boy just stood there looking down at his toes, curled like scared worms over the pool's edge. "You can swim like a fish, soldier boy. Just jump on in and swim your old dad. I'm right here, son. Nothing will happen. You won't drown," hollered Captain. But soldier boy knew he wouldn't drown. That wasn't it. Soldier boy stood there trembling like a cowardly leaf. Soldier boy wanted more than anything to be under the water of his beloved shallow end, holding his breath in a current of uncomplexity at his bottom. Where nobody could see him. "Come on now, soldier boy," Captain implored, gritting his teeth. I stared at my worried worms. "Come on now, goddammit, Chuck, jump," Captain encouraged me, and slapped the water with a cupped hand. It sounded like a shot. I flinched violently. "Why don't you go ahead and jump, chicken shit?" a neighborhood boy said from behind me and hooted with laughter. They were all around me, the neighborhood boys and girls, all those creepy kids with their giggles, their laughter. I spun around and ran. I pushed my way relentlessly through hooting human beings who knew my name. I skulked around that lake of a pool and slipped into the shameful shallow end on the far side. among the comforting presence of strangers where I felt safe and at home. I bobbed about in the shallow water, a floating head, keeping a wary eye out for Captain or any of the evil neighborhood kids while I plotted my revenge. If only I could transform this once sweet Persian dream of a pool into a lake of acid, or have schools of giant piranha churn the waves into a foam of blood. If only the creature of the deep end would awake while Captain is swimming out there all alone. When suddenly it happened, and with but a shudder of his great muscles, Captain would be pulled down into the deep end. And although my old man wrestled heroically with the groping tentacles, for he was such a big, brave shit, they slowly entangled him, pulling him into the dark water toward the deep end monster's huge, yellow, crazy eyes and great bloody maw. And then I heard an announcement over the clubhouse loudspeaker. They announced that we were all honored to have Dagmar, the famous star of screen and television, as a special guest that day at Dreamland. I stood up in a shallow end and looked around wildly. Dagmar, man, oh man. I saw a crowd passing slowly along the side of the pool by the clubhouse stairs toward the picnic area on the same slope where we had our stuff laid out. In a momentary parting of the excited throng, I was certain I caught a glimpse of utter blondness. For a moment, I considered returning to my site of shame, swallowing my pride in order to see that famous blonde person in her wondrous breast up close. But I didn't. I had my pride. I turned and dog paddled with dignity out to the float in the shallow end, where I pulled myself up and sat with my back to Dad and Dagmar and all they meant. At some point, I began jumping over and over again into the pool. Time and again, I would run and hurl myself belly first from that float painfully into the choppy water. Then I would drag myself up on that float and do it again. I didn't care. I didn't care if I knocked myself out and drowned shamefully at the bottom of the shallow end. I pictured Captain standing over where they had dragged my pitiful drowned body onto the side of the pool, blue-green water draining from my mouth and nose and ears and eyes. I tried to picture Captain crying his heart out, but I couldn't. The only thing I could make come alive in my imagination was Captain carrying my limp, dripping body up the clubhouse stairs, while some sad song like Endless Sea blared on the loudspeakers, and all the evil neighborhood kids were standing around wondering out loud if I would come back from the dead and fuck with them. Which, buddy, you could bet I would. Then I pictured Dagmar swimming toward me underwater, like a wondrous water plant's blooming. Her beautiful blonde hair floated about her head as her face came toward my own until it filled my vision. Whereupon, in the moment before I lost consciousness, I felt Dagmar's soft white arms enfold me. I was only 10 years old, but I imagined myself being deliciously smothered in the immensity of Dagmar's blonde breast as she delivered the drowning soldier boy safely to the surface. So there I stood in the shallow end trying to catch my breath after a particularly painful belly buster, when a kid came directly up to me out of the basic blue and excitedly said these exact words, "Dagmar saw you, boy. Dagmar saw you, boy." That kid said exactly that. I swear it. I spun around like an insane top. I looked everywhere. I looked at the water around the float. I scanned the far sides of the pool and the grassy slopes. Dagmar saw you, boy. When I looked back at the kid, he was gone. But that boy had been real, and he had said those exact words full of more wonder than any other words of my childhood. I swear it. Dagmar had spotted me. That much was clear. I believed that with all of my heart. I believe it to this day. Somehow my fierce, painful, brave belly busters had caught Dagmar's attention. Perhaps her blue, famous eyes were settled upon me at that moment. They could be. They were. I sprang into action. I threw myself from that float like a virgin into a volcano. I exploded into the violence of water and began to swim frantically for the float at the deep end. I thrashed my arms and kicked my feet wildly. I chopped across the rough surface of the deep end, choking, my eyes burning, toward the distant float. The deep end's water strangled into my throat with each ragged stroke, and it dawned on me that I might never make it. It dawned on me that I might actually drown like a rat. And for what? Fame? Fame wasn't worth it, I realized. Fame wasn't worth drowning like a rat. But at that epiphanal moment, I felt strangely calm. I closed my eyes and simply kept chopping, blindly, but unafraid, trance-like. And then suddenly, I touched concrete. I slapped an astonished hand onto the surface of the float in the deep end and held on for dear life. I had not drowned like a rat after all. I had a second chance at everything, including fame. I was coughing and spitting, and my sore arms trembled nearly out of control. I wiped water off of my face with my free hand and pushed my hair out of my eyes. I was there. Soldier Boy had made it. Soldier Boy was at the float in the deep end, where he had always really belonged. Soldier Boy loved that float with all of his heart. He gripped the edge of the float and looked around to see who had witnessed this amazing feat. He looked around for the evil neighborhood kids. He looked around for Dad. Soldier Boy looked around for Dagmar. And then suddenly, someone emerged from the water right beside me and grabbed the edge of the float. It was a famous girl with no face. I took one look at her and screamed. I screamed and I screamed and fell back into the water, flapping my arms like crazy wings. That's the end of that. That has haunted me all of my life. I mean, that happened. To think that girl, how brave she must have been to be out and about in public. I heard years later, I met someone, I read this in Huntington one time, and a gentleman came up to say he knew who she was. She lived in Sarita Canova, and he knew the family well. And her sister had been a beauty queen. And he said this young lady was one of the most remarkable people he had ever met. I mean, her heart and her soul were utterly beautiful. She accepted, and it's still not clear to me what had happened to her. But he said she was funny, the most engaging personality. And I think, what God's name, she thought, when this stupid little boy screamed, thrashed in the water. I mean, this has haunted me. You know, I was telling Mark in his class today, I'm not famous as for my conscience. You know, I'm not Captain Conscience, but that has preyed on me, that this, that image, like, at any rate, so she ended up in at least a weird little book. I'm going to read one more very short chapter toward the end of the book, and this is set in Morgantown. And I've been debating whether to read this, because it's a very sad subject, and it certainly relates to Morgantown, but I've decided to. And I just didn't, it's always changing my mind. But now I can't, can I? I'm not making light of this at all, believe me. But this is called The Ghost of the Headless Coeds. It's a bit harder for me to read. The ancient haunted hills of West Virginia are abundant with weird lights and apparitions and jokes. Excuse me, and ghosts. Those sad lost spirits of the restless and unhappily dead. The famous Greenbrier ghost even has her own state historical roadside marker, which reads, "Interred in nearby cemetery is Zona Hester Shue. Her death in 1897 was presumed natural until her spirit appeared to her mother to describe how she was killed by her husband, Edward. Autopsy on the exhumed body verified the apparition's account. Edward, found guilty of murder, was sentenced to the state prison. Only known case in which testimony from ghost helped convict a murderer." That's there, if any of you have ever read that. I mean, it's there. Other famous West Virginia ghosts include the Ashton ghost, and the ghost at Brigadoon, and the ghost of the Blue Lights, and the ghost of the lost girl of Grafton. Then there is a ghost of the boy crying in the rain, and a ghost of the lost hand at Prickard's Fort, and the ghost wagon of the Seven Loops. There's the conscientious ghost of Meadow River, and the ghost of the lost ladies of Sunrise, who were two Confederate camp-following beautiful young women captured and shot as wanton whore spies by jealous, spiteful, horny Yankees. Then there's a cave in Raleigh County haunted by two drunken ghosts of Confederate soldiers who stumble around while eternally singing Dixie. But the saddest ghosts in the state of West Virginia are the ghosts of the headless co-eds. On Saturday night of January 18, 1970, Meredith Malerick and Karen Farrell, two freshman co-eds at West Virginia University, made plans to see the movie Oliver with some friends in Morgan at the Metropolitan Theater in downtown Morgantown. It was a cold mountain night, and Merritt, a pretty 5'6" brunette from Kingston, from Kempton, actually, New Jersey, wrapped her slender body warmly in a brown fur coat. Karen, a petite blonde girl from Quinwood, West Virginia, wore a black coat, fur coat, and brown slacks. The movie let out around 11, and the girls decided to hitchhike back to their rooms in the Westchester Hall dormitory, which was located across town from the main campus. The girls' friends saw a cream-colored Chevrolet pull over at the intersection of where Merritt and Karen were hitchhiking, and they watched the girls climb in and a car pull out heading in the direction of the dorm, and the friends didn't give it a second thought. When the girls didn't return to their dorm that night, their disappearance was quickly noted and reported to the state police, whereupon a statewide bulletin was issued with their description, and an intense search was launched, but to no avail. Then on the 1st of March, 6 weeks after the girls' disappearance, a 13-year-old boy looking for empty pop bottles along U.S. Route 119 near Morgantown found Merritt's purse. At that point, Governor Archmore, the aforementioned elected outlaw who had years later would languish in a Texas federal pen, directed two units, about 100 men of the National Guard, to join the state police and an army of volunteers to search the rugged area inch by inch. Shortly before noon on Thursday, April 16th, several National Guardsmen were combing through a thick wilderness area of a narrow hollow about 100 yards from a dirt access road to an abandoned coal tipple near the old Weirton mine. They were joking about all the used rubbers they had found around the deserted secondary road, which was clearly a local lover's lane. One of the guardsmen, a fellow named David Noble, an old buddy of mine, was half-heartedly poking a stick into a large hole in a tree, checking for discarded weapons or body parts, or more hopefully, hidden contraband, jars of moonshine or bags of marijuana, say, when he happened to glance up at a scurrying sound. Noble lit a joint and stood there for a moment, gazing around the rough terrain, wondering how long this tramping around the woods business would go on. Then Noble spotted a gnawed human foot sticking from beneath a pile of brush about 10 feet away. As the authorities began uncovering the bodies, it became clear that their murderer had taken a great deal of time and effort to hide them. Six or seven slabs of heavy stone had been hauled from a nearby creek 30 feet away and placed over the corpses of the co-eds. And then the stones were in turn covered with logs and limbs and more rocks and then leaves until a small mound had been formed over the dead girls. Under the debris, both girls were found lying on their stomachs in something of a cruciform position, with Karen's, Farrell's legs crossing those of Merritt Malerick. Both bodies were badly decomposed. Also, both girls had been decapitated, and their heads were nowhere to be found. My buddy Noble showed up that evening at the Washington Cafe, or Augie's as we all called it, where all the hip Dover College kids and long-haired professors hung out in those days in Morgantown. Noble was still dressed in his muddy National Guard camouflage fatigues, something he was way too cool to normally do. I could tell something was bothering him. He was uncharacteristically quiet, for one thing, and didn't even strut about babbling and boasting as he usually did, anything to be the center of attention. Brewster Boy was Noble's nickname back in those days. Noble gulped down a couple of beers, not saying anything, and he kept running his hands back through his shaggy, dirty blonde hair and shaking his big, oddly shaped head. He was clearly rattled about something, and it occurred to me that he had finally strangled his beautiful wife, Susan, a woman Noble would divorce and remarry four times over the years to come, but he was just too cool to admit it. When the local evening news came on, Noble asked Augie, this little bit of an Italian fella who owned the place, to turn up the sound on the big set above the bar. And, lo and behold, there was Noble being interviewed on television about finding the bodies of the dead girls in the woods. During the interview, Noble had a cigarette coolly dangling from his thin lips, and he talked in a low but steady voice as he described in detail seeing a half-eaten foot of a dead girl sticking out from under a pile of debris deep in the dark woods. This is it, Noble had said directly to the television camera, and took a deep, dramatic drag off his cigarette while shaking his craggy, wolfish face. This is the end of ordinary life, Noble said, as he flipped the cigarette toward the trees. This town would never be the same for him, Noble said, now that he had discovered the headless bodies of those dead girls in the dark, heartless woods. Those dead girls had been some kind of a cruel signal for him, Noble said, some kind of evil sign of the times. Life, even a small university mountain community like Morgantown, Noble intoned meaningfully in his best baritone, could never be sweet and innocent and ordinary again. Noble was clearly stoned out of his mind at this, probably the high point of his life, in terms of attention and recognition anyway. At Augie's, you could have heard the proverbial pin drop until I started snickering. A month or so later, Noble took a notion to return to the scene of the crime, and I tagged along. After a half-hour drive over twisty blacktop two lanes, we finally pulled over and parked alongside that old dirt mine access road in the hills south of town. There was another car parked a ways up the road from us. I noticed it had New Jersey tags, and I recalled that Merritt Ballerick, one of the murdered co-eds, had been from New Jersey. The vehicle's empty, unless some couple was doing it down in the seat. Noble was subdued, and so was I. Instead of heading down the brush-filled slope into the shadowy woods to search for the scene of the crime, we both just hopped up on the warm hood of the car and fired up joints while we listened to country music on the radio and didn't have much to say. Ever since the bodies of the girls had been found, those woods had been packed with people in search of the lost heads, for which the girls' families had offered a hefty reward. Most of those searchers had been sincere, sad, and serious, but some were carloads of drunken, idiot, frat rat louse, the kind of punks who toddle tombstones for a prank, and to whom the dead girls simply meant a little less nookie in the world, but some potential reward money. Those frat bums had taken to running through the hills with flashlights for fraternity initiations, hooting and screeching insanely as though those woods were their own to haunt like evil, angry spooks. Finally, some carload of drunk dopes had roared back into town one night with the story of the headless ghost of the girls, who the wasted witnesses claimed they had seen stumbling silently through the trees exactly like what they were, namely the headless ghosts of girls without eyes to see or tongues to cry out, their slender, smoky arms outstretched as they groped and lurched and clutched and waved both hands like haze before them. Unlike the stories of the lovely ghost of the White Ladies of Powell Mountain, or even the drowned ladies of Cheat Lake who rose from the mist and fog full of sad grace and beauty. The ghosts of the headless co-eds were awkward and gangly, goofy and comical somehow in their recounting, like the funny old stories of the headless English ghost of Anne Boleyn, lurching and weaving in and out of stone walls and walking out of windows to be blown about castle battlements like a tiny cloud. We sat on the hood of the car, smoking as evening, as arriving spring evening, settled as gently as a warm fog onto the mountain. The shadows down the slope spreading and thickening like thick black pools of oil. The damp odor of the woods hung in the clean mountain air like fresh wash left out all day in the sun. The fresh smell of resin rose from a stand of pines at the edge of the trees. The sure, comforting sound of cicadas began to click from the brush and from the trees down the slope and from around the darkening shapes of rocks that looked like big black eggs scattered about the hillside. A few early lightning bugs blinked like small hot eyes in the darkening air. Although the sky was clear and I could see the evening star and the pale rising cat grin moon, there was a light breeze with a clean feel of coming rain in it. Ordinary words cannot capture the profound sense of sadness of the presence of such a vast unhappiness I suddenly felt there alive at the edge of those sweet woods. Noble fired up another joint, and after holding a big toke until he was bug-eyed, he began babbling about the loss of ordinary life again. Those girls would sure never return to their sweet, young, ordinary lives again. The only world those dead girls had now before them was all of death, all of evil. And the families, the moms and dads and friends of those murdered girls, they would be haunted by the lost faces of those young girls forever. Boyfriends would grow old remembering the sweet scent of those girls' summer skins, the spring-like water taste of their mouths, Noble muttered, admitting perhaps probably the most poetic words of his turbulent life. I was 27 that year. What came to me that evening by the woods was that my own ordinary life, such as it was over for me. At that point, I didn't have any idea, one, about how or exactly when, but I knew I was on a bus out of my own ordinary life. And in August of that summer, I did it. I left my first wife and punted my promising teaching position. I got on a Greyhound bus and rode it west, wide-eyed, with fear and hope to San Francisco, that gateway to the age of Aquarius, to start all over again, maybe reinvent myself as some kind of flower child, another endeavor I felt it utterly. The stars came out over those woods where Noble had found the bodies of the dead girls, and the pure, tender mountain air of that spring night was cool and calm and unconcerned. I trembled suddenly, and tears sprang to my eyes. I felt like such a fucking sap. I glanced over to see if Noble had noticed my momentary sentimental collapse, but he was just smoking and looking off into the night woods. I flipped my butt sparking toward the woods, hopped down off the hood, and hauled out my hog for some relief. But just as I started to let fly, aiming my golden arc toward the dark line of trees, the hair on the back of my neck suddenly bristled. I had a sudden feeling that Noble and I were not alone there at the edge of the woods. I had a terrific, almost instinctive sense of another presence. The night around us was full of this feeling, shaky with this awareness. The grass and bushes and trees down the slope almost crackling with it. When I looked into the dark woods, I saw something moving through them. But it had not been a sad, goofy, stumbling ghost of a headless girl. What I saw was a single, small, round, roving light. It was a flashlight, the fast flashlight of somebody searching high and low for things lost in the woods. Somehow, I knew it was somebody from New Jersey, the owner of the car up the road from us, some father or brother or boyfriend. from New Jersey, searching for things lost in the woods. And just what would they do, I wonder, if they actually found them, those dead, those lost heads of the dear murdered girls. The light moved slowly among the trees within the dark woods like a little yellow lost moon. And that's that. I'd be pleased to entertain any questions you might have. Going once? Going twice? Believe me, I don't, you know, I'll just have to entertain them. I'm saying this out of courtesy, but I will. And as honestly as I'm capable of.
How did you fail in your attempt to become a flower child?
Well, for one thing, I was raised, as many West Virginians are, on roadkill. And I love braised possum sandwiches. My sister makes the best braised possum pork roll sandwiches as you can imagine. And out there, I mean, we weren't supposed to eat meat, for instance. And I couldn't abide that. Plus I've become fond of fisticuffs. Now that served me well when I became, because all the hippie girls were all commies back then. And there was a lot of street battling with the pigs back then. And I was rather adept at that. So that served me well. I mean, so I became a commie. But not, I was a pretty good commie. I think it was a commie for about 6.5 months. But I just wasn't a very good flower child. I just wasn't a very good hippie, really. Even my little scraggly ponytail notwithstanding.
Yeah, I have a couple questions. First of all, did you know that Jessica White is coming to Morgantown in October?
No, I didn't know that.
She's actually performing downtown. But I read your book.
Don't miss it.
I hope that I will be there. I read Last Mountain Dancer, and I was wondering, of all the places, like the Mystery Hole and the New Gorge Bridge and all that stuff, what do you think is like the best place of the things that you talk about in that book?
My sister's back porch with my handsome parachute brother-in-law plucking one of his banjo or guitar. I mean, he can make music come from anything he stretches string across. I call Fayetteville Billville in the book. I mean, I was trying to hide some things. But I would say definitely my favorite place of all of West Virginia, perhaps in all the world, is my sister's back to deck and with my old mama there. My mother is still alive at 88. She's turned 88. She doesn't know this book. Well, she has the inkling of it, but she doesn't know this book exists. We have steadfastly. But the things there that I mean, my mom, when I was down there, after my dad died, my mom moved from Bethany to Fayetteville, Billville, and sort of reinvented herself as a Baptist church lady, speaking of reinvention. And she's a sincere Baptist church lady, but she has a certain, she falls back from that a little bit. For instance, she does like her little white Russians. You know, she calls them a church lady. I call them church lady elixir. She calls them her special oval team. So I would spend evenings with mom, and I'd be doing shots of Jack Straight, of course. And she lets me smoke cigars even in her house, which reminds her of her father. And I would just take still stories from her. Okay, mom, what happened then? And finally, one night she brought out a little blue bound book, and it's the diary she kept. I said, Mom, don't do this. Don't give it to me. And Mom, don't do it, man. You have mom material, I'll use it. You know I will. And she said, basically, Jackie, I can't abide the thought of you putting words in my mouth that I never did say. She says, I know you better than anyone on the face of the earth, and I know you lie like a rug. And I took that book, and I was chapter here, the story of my mother's life in her own words. And so Mama, yeah, she doesn't really, now the poor things, can't see well enough to read. How did I get to that? Oh, just talk about my sister's back porch with my mom sitting there in my handsome hair suit, your brother-in-law plucking away. Yeah, Jessica, that's how I met him. Diane and I returned from a trip over to Crook Island. We used to go down there on vacations. Got run off by a hurricane named Bob. And we stopped at Fayetteville to visit Beth and John, and they pulled me inside to watch this film. The friend that sent them is about Jessica, it was that dancing outlaw.
I
called me. Well, Jacob's a good friend of mine. He comes up and spends time with me in Pittsburgh, and he's a dear friend. We might even stay down at Beth and John's on occasion. He's done that. But at any rate, about a year later, or that Thanksgiving, brought us to the hell of it. Diane couldn't go with me for some reason. She wasn't with us. But three of us and a couple of the friends got their big old van and drove down to Boone County, just sort of jokingly, let's go find Jessica White. And we did. And we hit it off. I mean, Jessica and I became friends. And so I really want to write a book about him. But I haven't seen him or talked to him in years now. I have things. I showed Jessica films to my grad students. You get a big packet of it. I sent Jessica for Christmas one year. It was the year that all the tapes came out. That's how long ago it was. But the Elvis tapes. And Jessica sent me back a great big belt buckle. It's a green mail. I mean, I'm so proud of that. Yeah, don't miss Jessica. Don't miss Jessica when he's content. Yeah.
Do you have a favorite Raymond Carver story? Do you have a favorite story about Raymond Carver?
I have many favorite Raymond Carver stories from different periods of his life. In fact, in Mark's, with Mark and Preston's day, I was talking about the story Cathedral. I've seen that story in a couple different versions, and I had particular thoughts about it that I ran by Ray. Do I have stories about Ray? I can suggest a book you could read. There's a book called Honeymoon, Oxford Hotel. At this point in my life, I'd be disingenuous to say that it's not, they call it a Romana Clef. Truthfully, I thought for years, I thought Romana Clef was a book about an Italian chef or something. But it was determined that Romana Clef. There it is. And I'd be, just as I said, disingenuous about Ray and myself and my wife and one thing or another. I'll sign it for you if you go buy one. If you buy one. Any others?
Did Tess Gallagher get upset over what you wrote in Honeymooners?
We've never talked about it. I do know that she was a center copy, of course. Of all the old Ray's old friends, I'm the only one that's remained friends with Tess. I mean, the others, they don't like her. For one reason or another, but I gave her a copy of the book, and then I never heard from her, Variety. It was several years ago. She didn't write about it back, and I felt too embarrassed. I heard through other mutual acquaintances that she was busily at my back, but somehow that subsided. And within the last year, we're back, we're communicating again. And Diane found in an old drawer a little snapshot, all wrinkly and used up, and it was taken of Ray and Tess. A friend of ours named Max Crawford and a guy named Mike Kapp. Diane took the picture, and a guy named James Crumney, who just died last Wednesday, that great, great crime novel writer. And so what Diane did, I have no idea how she did it, but she blew it up. And it still has these little black lines in it. They look like rain or something. It's so appropriate. And we framed copies for everybody and sent it to Tess. And Tess wrote back she was also seeking support because, she's putting out that new book of Ray's stories and earlier versions, and everyone's just attacking her for doing that. My thought is, I don't care, number one. But number two, I know wherever Carver is, he's loving it. That here, 20 years after his death, people are still talking about his controversial. He is, whatever bar he's at, great beer drawing the sky, he's loving it. So that's my only. So I'm not on Tess's side in that controversy, but I don't care. So, but anyway, we're back in touch, and it's quite warm again. Plus, we're in touch with Mary Ann, his first wife. Although, never mind. I won't be down that path. Any others, or are we repaired to the beer joints?
Thank you so much.
Thank you.